Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulaby. This week on Culturetopia, at a moment when it seems like there's nothing that great in theaters, our movie critic is wowed by a documentary that's about a Brazilian race car driver named Senna. The classic Gershwin opera Porgy and Bess gets a surprising story-driven reboot. And a look at blues dancing, a romantic style that asks people to dance as though they're deeply in love, even if they've never met, and its life-changing effects. But first,
photographer Elliot Erwitt loves babies, bare bottoms, and dogs. And in May, the International Center of Photography gave him a Lifetime Achievement Award for his pictures of those and many other subjects. Some of Elliot Erwitt's photographs have a permanent home in our mind's eye, as NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg learned at a show of his works in New York.
Dogs first. Elliot Erwitt has lots of pictures of them jumping. Dogs jumping.
Whenever I bark, you get a strange reaction from dogs sometimes.
Oh, that's how you got these pictures? You bark at them?
Yes, of course. You have to speak their language.
Do they bark back?
Sometimes they bark back, sometimes they jump. Once one of them peed on my leg as a consequence.
Elliot Erwitt became a professional photographer, commercial and photojournalism, in 1950, and he's still at it. What's the last picture you took?
Well, I had a birthday party yesterday in East Hampton. I think I took a picture of somebody barbecuing.
He'd had turned 83 the day before we spoke at the International Photography Center. Nice party?
Everyone said I had a wonderful time.
Good picture?
I don't know. It's still in the camera.
Elliot Erwitt uses film, mostly black and white. He rarely crops and never manipulates an image electronically. He composes in the camera. Some of his photographs over the years have become classics.
That picture is of my first wife, my first child, and my first cat.
Taken in 1953 in New York City, baby Ellen Erwitt was 6 days old, lying on her belly on the bed, bare-bottomed. The cat, Brutus, sits near her feet. The wife and mother rests at the corner of the bed, gazing lovingly at her child.
It's the only frame on a roll of photographs.
A spontaneous family snapshot, chosen for the groundbreaking 1955 Museum of Modern Art Family of Man photography exhibition, an exercise in international humanism. Erwitt's simple, moving black and white personal family picture has had a long public life.
It's been used as a illustration for the last 57 years. It's put my daughter through college.
Amazing longevity when you consider how many photographs of mothers, babies, and cats there are in this world. The only color picture in the New York exhibit was taken more recently, January 20th, 2009, at one of the inaugural balls. President and Mrs. Obama up on a brightly lit stage, waving at the crowd, and all across the bottom half of the photo, the crowd waves back with a sea of upraised, illuminated smartphones.
It's used as an illustration about the use of cameras these days.
Inaugurals, graduations, birthday parties, backyard barbecues, everybody's taking pictures. Too many? The Magnum photographer gives a wry smile.
All you need is a pencil and a piece of paper to write a novel, don't you?
But it won't necessarily be War and Peace.
Exactly. Yeah. And not even with a very good pencil.
Another classic in this show of more than 100 of Erwitt's favorite photographs was made in 1955 on assignment in France. A country road lined on each side with trees, pedaling down it on a bicycle, their backs to us and wearing berets, a man and behind him a little boy, and behind them, tied to the rear of the bike, two long, skinny baguettes.
I did a lot of tourist jobs in the 50s and 60s for airlines, for countries, and that was a picture I took for the French tourist campaign.
So what did they say to you? Go out and take typical pictures of things you see around France, or go find a kid on the back of a bicycle with a baguette and take a picture of him?
No. In those days, there were no focus groups to decide what you should do.
It was up to the photographer. Today, Elliot Erwitt says, ad agencies and clients tell commercial photographers exactly what they want before the camera sees anything. The suits have found a bar they like, say, and want it shot from various angles, period. So it's unlikely that a straight-ahead, spur-of-the-moment baby or baguette will last through the decades, as so many of Erwitt's have. Here's his theory about why some do last.
If your subjects are sort of eternal, you might say, mm-hmm. they'll survive if they're good enough. If they're not dated, they will survive.
Another lasting black and white picture from years back, the fall of 1963, presents one of the darkest moments in this nation's history. Erwitt took the picture at graveside in Arlington National Cemetery. The just-widowed Jacqueline Kennedy holds a folded American flag. A dark veil shrouds her agonized face.
The sadness of the widow, I mean, it's all there. It's all there.
You see her grief, this woman who has been so majestic and so controlled and regal, really. But in this moment, she becomes the grieving one.
And you can see you can even see a tear if you get close. Hmm. Stuck on the veil.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Now, I suppose this is a silly question for a professional photographer, but is there something voyeuristic here of getting that close at that moment of deep, deep emotion?
It's a historic event. I don't think it's voyeurism. Mm-hmm. Covering a historic event is... It's perfectly legitimate. It's not sneaking into somebody's boudoir.
But in our looking at it this many years later, are we invading privacy that should belong to her at such a moment?
I don't think so. These people belong to history, and I think not to record that if you have the opportunity would be wrong.
Elliot Erwitt. His pictures are on exhibit at the International Center of Photography in New York through August 28th. The day after we spoke, he went off to Scotland on assignment for a whiskey company. Just get atmosphere, they told him. When you're Elliot Erwitt, you get lucky sometimes. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
Porgy and Bess, the classic American folk opera about life and love in an African-American fishing community, was a great dream for its collaborators, composers George and Ira Gershwin, and author DuBose Hayward, who wrote the 1925 novel, Porgy. But it wasn't as successful as they had hoped when it premiered in 1935. So now, after 76 years, the Gershwin and Hayward Trusts are reviving Porgy and Bess in a new adaptation. It's now in previews at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, with plans to move it to Broadway in December. Andrea Shea of member station WBUR has been following the project's evolution since April.
Messing with a classic will always make people mad. The creative team working on the new Porgy and Bess knew that from the get-go. Writer Susan Laurie Parks and musical adapter Deirdre Murray recall long hours in windowless rooms sweating over the monumental task they agreed to take on.
We were saying, what are we doing? What are we doing? And that's what you'd say. You said, I'm modernizing without disturbing.
Yes.
I think I'm disturbing some things.
Before their adaptation even reached an audience, musical theater legend Stephen Sondheim sent a letter to the editor of the New York Times, accusing the new Porgy and Bess team of arrogance and dishonoring the creator's intentions. But the opera's been in flux since its very first performance. The story goes that after opening night, George Gershwin and his collaborators pace through Boston Common, arguing over cuts to their four-hour work. Robert Kimball, friend of Ira Gershwin and longtime artistic advisor to the Gershwin estate, says they probably would have kept at it had they lived.
Because two of the creators died so very soon after the premiere in 35, George died in 1937 and DuBose in 1940, we really don't know what they would have done with the piece. most operas go through changes from city to city, from year to year. There would have been changes here as well.
That's not to say the opera hasn't been done since. There have been plenty of performances and a film. But the Gershwin and Hayward estates turned to Tony Award-winning director Diane Paulus to bring the work back to the stage in a new way. The artistic director at the American Repertory Theater recalls watching a Metropolitan Opera production of Porgy and Bess.
And I remember sitting there in that fancy opera house thinking, this is a great piece of musical theater. And not musical theater the way we tend to think, you know, song and dance and light and entertainment, but deeply moving, powerful music, characters, drama, emotion, catharsis.
It was the story, though, that attracted most of Paulus's attention. She felt the narrative needed clarification. The plot still unfolds in a fictitious neighborhood called Catfish Row. It's still set around 1920. But baritone Philip Boykin, who sung the role of Crown many times before, says letting him talk more allows his character to express more.
In the operas, usually, the focus is mainly on the voice. In this production, the focus is really on allowing the audience to see these as real people and to go deeper into the characters.
There's the woman I'm looking for. Why you ain't coming here and say hello to your man?
You ain't her man.
It's sure time I was coming back for you, sweetheart.
At a workshop in May in New York, Diane Paulus introduced the cast to her notion that the original libretto would be fleshed out, or mined, as she says, to make the update more like a piece of musical theater or a play than an opera. Audra McDonald says she learned more about her character, Bess, as Paulus and Parks laid out more of the backstory.
Okay, at this moment, they're going through withdrawal, cocaine withdrawal. At this moment, someone has just been murdered. At this moment, someone is promising to murder someone. I mean, all these things, when we put them into a very realistic context, the songs come even more alive.
Is still a beautiful drug addict, torn between her brutish boyfriend, Crown, and her growing love for the charming disabled beggar, Porgy. But Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Susan Laurie Parks, who was hired to open the script, had lots of questions about what made these characters tick. For instance, the opera never explains why Porgy is disabled, so Parks turned to the source.
In the book, you go to the original novel, the Bose Hayward's novel, and you realize he's crippled from birth. So we put in the line, crippled from birth. I'm crippled from birth, God made me to be lonely. That's in the show. What does that mean, to marry those two things together? A piece of information with the statement, God made me to be lonely, which was in the original. We put them together, and suddenly here's a man who's having a conversation with God, which is from before the day I was born. You made me to be lonely. And into my life comes the most beautiful, cool, sexiest, most awesome chick. And I fall in love with her.
To make that more believable, Parks and her collaborators made a controversial decision to eliminate one of the opera's key plot devices. In the original, Porgy makes his way around town in a goat cart. Here, he walks with a cane. The creative team also added text to address a longtime criticism of the opera, that it's racist. Parks points to the song, I Got Plenty of Nothing.
That's the song that people, folks go, ah, man, that's a racist song, you know. It's basically the happy darky with the empty pockets song.
That didn't bother Parks as much as her feeling that the song didn't work dramatically. So she added dialogue to set it up.
So when Porgy comes out of the house, he says,
good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Porgy.
He's just been in the house with Bess. So he comes out of the house with a big smile on his face, and they say, what you been up to? And he's like,
nothing. Oh, nothing.
they all start laughing. A bunch of guys on stage are all laughing. And he starts singing.
I got plenty of nothings, and nothing's plenty for me.
At rehearsals earlier this month, Parks and the rest of the team said it's important to remember that the opera's creators stipulated it would always be performed by an all-black cast. And to this day, their estates hold firm to that requirement. Norm Lewis, who plays Porgy, points out the opera's first national tour played a role in desegregating, briefly, the National Theater in Washington, D.C. The original Porgy, Todd Duncan, refused to go on stage unless all seats were open to all colors for all performances.
And this was in the late 1930s, early 40s. And this was before civil rights actually really started. So for him to have that sort of wherewithal and power and strength and courage to do something like that was a major milestone.
Throughout the entire process, director Diane Paulus especially felt George Gershwin's presence.
Every time in rehearsal, you know, when a music stand falls down or a book falls off and something crashes, you know, we're always like, there's Gershwin. You know, I think he's in the room with us all the time. And actually, I think what makes it such a powerful classic is that you do feel like you're in dialogue with what they gave us 76 years ago, that we are still working on and still mining beat by beat, word for word, note by note.
And writer Susan Laurie Parks has this clarification for what the cast calls the purists out there.
We haven't touched the opera, actually. What we did is, you know, on your computer, you push duplicate. We're making another show. We're not saying this will replace the original brilliant opera called Porgy and Bess. And again, the Gershwins asked us to.
Of course, the Gershwin and Hayward estates stand to earn royalties on the new production of what's now called the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. But more importantly, they say, they want the classic tale to reach 21st century audiences who don't usually go to the opera house and maybe have only heard the song Summertime sung by a contestant on American Idol. For NPR News, I'm Andrea Shea in Boston.
Now to a film about car racing's most legendary maverick. If you know who Artun Sena is, this is the film for you. If you don't, Los Angeles Times and Morning Edition film critic Kenneth Duran says Sena is the perfect vehicle to find out.
This is a documentary with the pace of a thriller. A story of motors and machines that is compelling because of the human story it tells. Brazil's Artun Sena was the boy genius of Formula One racing, winner of three world championships, before dying in a crash in 1994 at age 34. A driver current and former Formula One racers recently voted the greatest who ever lived.
How do you feel about being world champion?
What is that like?
It's not a bad feeling at all, is it?
More than anything, Sena was a driver who wouldn't play the game, who loathed the politics he felt he saw all around him.
Pure driving, pure racing. That makes me happy.
The game playing started with his first significant race, the 1984 Monaco Grand Prix, where Sena, described as a genius in the rain, came from 13th place to just about win the race before a controversial maneuver gave it to France's Alain Prost. Prost turned out to be Senna's bête noire. The savage rivalry between them is something to behold. But if all Sena could do was race, this wouldn't be much of a film. Though Sena drove like the devil, he was a spiritual person who believed deeply and profoundly in a higher power. A philosophical mystic with a jewel thief's nerves and a poet's sensitivity and killer good looks, Sena was an altogether remarkable human being. Sena is that rare documentary where we see nothing but archival footage. People talk about him, but you only hear them in voiceover. The filmmakers had 5,000 hours of footage from 10 countries to choose from. This included intimate home movies, shots taken inside Senna's car while he was driving, and riveting footage of frequently tempestuous drivers-only meetings held before each race. Artun Sena was such an innately dramatic personality that every race he took part in seems like the most intense possible. Until we see the next one. such is the power of this man and this film.
Kenneth Duran reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times.
We're going to take a turn now on the dance floor. There's a style called blues dancing. It's a kind of marriage between European and African American styles, born in the Jim Crow South. They say that dancing to the blues is like falling in love. That's what attracted reporter Lindsay Lee Keel. Here's what she found.
I put a spell on you.
You hear that? It's Nina Simone, and this is the blues.
'Cause you're mine.
It's Monday night in San Francisco's Mission District, and I've just arrived at the Polish Club. It's not a bar, it's a community center that tonight and every Monday night attracts a crowd of devout blues dancers. The room is warm, the windows have begun to fog, the lighting is dim, couples are close, dancing slowly, arms around necks, heads on shoulders, foreheads pressed together. Hips pulsate with the beat. Partners spin out for a moment of space between them, and then they move together again like molecules that can't resist each other. Though it might look like it, these dancers are not in love with each other. Some may not even know the name of the person they're dancing with, but everyone is here for that connection, for that feeling.
It's falling in love, that's what it is. It's crazy.
This is Kat Hughes. She's been a blues dancer for 3 years.
Every dance is like a love affair. You're falling in love for 3 minutes with the music, with your partner, with your connection. And it can be dangerous because you're falling in love like a million times a night, and it can really screw with your emotions, but it can also be amazing.
Dancing this way takes some getting used to. Back when she was first starting, blues dancer Crystal Wanberg remembers telling a prominent dancer in the scene how nervous she was.
And he was like, okay, just play along with me. Pretend that I am your one true love. And I kind of gave him this weird look. He's like, wait. I am your one true love, and I've been called off to war, and I'm leaving tomorrow. You may never see me again. He's like, dance with me like that. And I was just like, ah.
Wanberg was hesitant, but then she gave in.
And then we danced, and it was just the most incredibly connected dance. I was completely, completely done. Like, I was a blues dancer after that. It was done.
Many dancers talk about before blues and after blues. Vari Leggett started dancing almost 2 years ago. She says before blues, she had a drinking problem. She struggled with a negative body image. She sometimes felt suicidal. But after blues,
I have become more connected to my body. You can't go to a dance and say, I don't want to be reminded that my body exists, because that's what dancing is. And so that's extremely important for me, because I had never before found a situation where I wanted that to be true.
For Leggett, blues dancing is about transformation.
My release from fear and sadness started with getting sober and ended with learning to dance. Because of those two things, I am awake and I am healing.
Blues music was once called the devil's music. But for so many, blues has saved them. Though the Polish Club may not have a neon sign that says, blues saves, shining like a guiding light for the wayward, and you won't see dancers at your door holding pamphlets, for Hughes, Wanberg, and Leggett, the road to a better life began at the Church of Blues. For NPR News, I'm Lindsay Lee Keel.
Oh.
This is fingerstyle guitar playing, one hand forming the chords, the other plucking out notes. It takes a certain dexterity and a whole lot of practice to get this good. So when aspiring guitarist Larry Brown started having trouble controlling two of his fingers, he thought his career might end almost as soon as it began. But here he is, playing the song you're listening to right now, without the use of those two fingers. He performs under the name Gray Reverend, and his debut solo album is called Of the Days. And the diagnosis for his fingers? Vocal dystonia.
It's a neurological misfiring to your digits. And it's something that happens to pianists, surgeons, typists, and guitar players. A particular person who is kind of famous for working through this is Leon Fleischer, the classical pianist. I started dealing with problems with my hands within 2 or 3 years of playing the instrument.
When did you start playing the guitar?
15 years ago. So yeah, that would be 1996.
If you don't mind my asking, were you young? Were you a teenager?
No, I was 22 years old.
You started playing the guitar when you were 22 years old?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I started off kind of, I wanted to be Wes Montgomery.
The jazz guitarist.
Yes, I really wanted to just be this like ripping jazz guitar person. And then because of that, I practiced constantly. I probably played about 12 or 13 hours a day.
Wow.
And not to say that exactly leads to it. It's a very random disease that can affect anyone.
So the guitar playing, it sounds like exacerbated, sort of an underlying condition you didn't even know you had.
Yeah, I guess it kind of, it was dormant to a degree, and it came out. And I lost basically the ability to use my ring finger and my little finger on my left hand.
What went through your head when that happened?
It was horrible. I didn't know what it was. For so long, I was seeing chiropractors and, everyone under the sun to try to figure out what was wrong with me. I thought I had arthritis, tendonitis, every other type of itis. And I finally went to see a piano player who he was the first person to mention focal dystonia. And at first I thought like, oh, great, I'm brain damaged and, it's the end. But I kind of looked it up, obviously, started reading more about it, and I realized that it was something I just kind of had to deal with, and I had to make a decision as to whether I would continue to play the instrument or not. And in making that decision, I became very immersed in different styles of guitar playing, kind of getting into folk singers such as Joni Mitchell and blues players like Mississippi John Hurt. And particularly John Fahey. I heard his music and his sound and what he was doing with the music seemed like something I could understand.
Did what happened to your fingers change the way you were playing the music, or did it? It sounds like you're saying it changed the music you were playing.
It did, to a very strong degree, in that I stopped using a guitar pick. And I started learning how to play with my fingers on my right hand, more like a classical style or folk kind of finger picking style.
Far down the road, pioneer performs an episode. You can't pull me through.
Basically, a lot of the syncopation and a lot of the movement that started to occur was happening more with my right hand than my left because I couldn't use the left as well. And I eventually developed a technique of using my thumb on my left hand to play very standard chords. And that helped me to be able to construct my own songs or write pieces of music that would have moving bass lines in them that you wouldn't hear very often.
Well, you brought your guitar with you.
I did.
Today. Would you mind playing a little bit from one of these new songs and tell me a little bit about it before you start?
Okay. I'll play a tune called Box. I was having a discussion with another musician. This is years ago in Philadelphia. He admired this guy he was working with who could write songs about anything. And he said he could write a song about a box. That's how that's how great this guy's writing is. I was challenged to write a song about a box. And to long story short, the approach to writing a song about a box was using the idea of something that, you know, I feel like most people can identify with throughout growing up and having relationships is you always have this box of photos around that, you know, have pictures of your ex lovers and friends. And sometimes you kind of, you know, when you're cleaning or something, you'll find it and you just start kind of looking through it, and it can evoke such nostalgia. And that's kind of what this song is about.
Okay, so this is Gray Reverend with Box.
Some days seem to go so fast, getting lost in your photograph, taken just before sun goodbye. But I saved all that we could be in a box made memories. Some say that it's not good for me. Doesn't matter where I go, up above or down below, no one knows the troubles I've seen. I don't mind how you feel today, 'cause in time we all get thrown away. When it seems an expiration date is on our love. So don't ask me why it takes so long. Sometimes I see it when it's gone, and sometimes I'm made for holding on. It doesn't matter where I go, up above or down below, no one knows the troubles I've seen. You can say it's mystery, but everything's so clear to me when I look inside that box. It's to remind me.
That is incredible. It's just lovely to listen to you to play the guitar like that.
Well, thanks.
That's the music of Gray Reverend performing Box, a track off his new album Of the Days. He spoke to us from our New York bureau. Larry, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Copper buttons, well, they're way too much.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Neda Ulibi. Culturetopia is produced by Mike Katziff and executive produced by Sarah Saracen. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.
Seems the thick was just too thin. Free the dog from its collar now.